Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the clot in my cream. Oh, that's a belter. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, Dave, how are you, pal? Bit nippy, isn't
good. Pardon?
A bit nippy?
It is a little bit nippy, yes. You are absolutely right. That's what happens at wintertime, though, isn't it?
I know.
I'm missing the summer and the beer gardening and the paddleboarding and the barbecuing and all those other things that I think suits us much more.
Well, I'm missing the beer and the beer garden and the barbecuing. Stuff the rest.
I know. But you know what? It's not important right now because we have this beautiful podcast to keep us warm and toasty like chestnuts during the wintertime. And it's made only warmer like a warm fire by the standard of beautiful guests that we have joining us to chat.
You could even describe this podcast today as unctuous, I think.
Unctuous.
Hey?
Yes, unctuous. I'm not entirely sure what it means, but it sounds warming and nice.
No, me neither. I bet it's the umami or something.
Umami.
Umami.
Hang on. Isn't umami... Hang on, we're going to get the clarity on this in a minute. Isn't umami what Vic and Bobby used to say on Shooting Stars? Or was,
yes!
That was umami.
That was uvavu and urano.
Umami.
Oh, I'm going to, after this podcast is done, I'm going to get that on YouTube and watch those two. Anyway, we digress. Our guest today is a gentleman who knows a thing or two about food. And I'm talking about the good stuff, you know, like proper food.
Yeah.
He's one of this country's most exciting chefs, having trained in some of the finest kitchens around the world and now proud owner of a small battalion. I'm going to call them sexy restaurants.
Yeah,
it is, of course, my good pal, the one and only Mr. Paul Ainsworth. Hello, mate. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, good.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And you two are just like wordsmiths. It's beautiful to listen to.
Well, listen, Paul, it's very kind of it's very kind of you to say. I mean, the reality is that actually, you know, there's we're not very good at anything else. Well, I mean, Jason obviously very good at driving, but you know, otherwise we're sort of very good at just talking rollocks, you know, with nice people like you who take the time to join us. So we're very, very pleased that we're here, obviously, and very pleased that you're here as well. Paul, we've watched you on the telly for many, many years now and obviously enjoyed seeing your food empire growing. Take us back to the beginning, if you will, for those that don't know your backstory. You started off in hospitality, didn't you? Weren't you brought up in that world?
Yeah, I was, absolutely. I was born in a bed and breakfast called the Bitton Park Guest House. It was my mum and dad's business. So unknowingly growing up, you know, when you're sort of 5-6 years old, the family home was also the business.
Yeah.
And I also remember my dad sort of saying as well, you know, at the school gates, he took a bit of stick, you know, sort of some prude parents that felt that, you know, what's that like bringing kids up in a business? But
yeah,
I absolutely loved it. And little did I know that I was in this world of hospitality. So when my mates answered the phone, and remember, this is an era. Do you remember when people used to answer the phone and say their phone number?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that about?
Yeah. Like, Newcastle 48211. God, do you remember?
In Southampton, they didn't even say the area code. Hello, 553568.
Why did we do that? But the irony being, though, that actually they've clearly got through. So, you know, there's no doubt whether they've got the number correctly or not, because if they hadn't, they wouldn't be talking to you, which was the whole sort of absurdity of it.
Hey, just going sideways, do you remember Hong Kong Fui, and there was that lady with all the cables?
What was
her name?
She was the operator.
Operator. Do you remember her?
I'll think of her name before the end of it. That'll be my challenge.
But no, mine was, we had to answer the phone, me and my sister. Hello, Bitton Park Guest House. Paul speaking. How can I help? So, and then as I kind of got older, you know, you got real good kudos off the old man, you know, if you took a booking. You know, if you got a free nighter, he'd be well happy. So, it was a brilliant time, and it also introduced me to a fantastic work ethic. So yeah, that's how it began for me.
Good stuff.
Wow. And was it? Yeah, but God bless him. The good old Gary Rhodes that gave you your first break. Is that true?
Yeah. So I went to college, and then my college lecturer was really good friends with Gary Rhodes. They went to college together. Gary was opening a restaurant in London. I'd worked at the Star Hotel in Southampton whilst at college. I was always, if I wanted college, I was working in kitchens. Then I moved to the New Forest to Carey's Manor, Brockenhurst. And then, yeah, the big break came working for Gary Rhodes. He was just opening a restaurant in Pimlico called Rhodes and Square in Dolphin Square Hotel.
Yeah.
And that was a game changer. And I have got to always shout out Gary because, again, you know what London's like. It was 6 weeks up front, a month's rent, all of that. And Gary put me up in the hotel for 3 months. Let me save up enough money to put a deposit down. And then I moved into the most wretched bedsit you could ever. It was so bad that my mum cried her eyes out. Oh, right, nice. But my dad, giving you an idea of my dad was like, Annabelle, when it's this crap, there's only one way to go. And just left me there.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing was, I grew up where my mum and dad drove an Escort like all the time, but my dad had go-to cars. My dad had, he loved Jags, and the Jag was for best. The Jag was, we'd go out for a Sunday drive. Nowhere, just driving aimlessly around Hampshire, in the Jag. So yeah, so he took me in the Jag to this bed sits, and yeah, basically was, yeah, Paul, when it's as bad as this, there's only one way for you to go, son.
Yeah, I think that's what they call character building, isn't it?
Stuff. Yes, like, your dad
was there thinking, do you know what? He's had some time in the hospitality trade. He knows that you have to earn your stripes. And he was obviously then sort of thinking, this will be no bad thing. And obviously, I'm sure now when you look back on it, it was character building and would have made you the person that you are. I mean, in addition to Gary Rhodes, obviously, Gordon Ramsay and Marcus Waring that you've worked with as well. So, I mean, you know, you have genuinely been in some of the finest kitchens of all time. Do you find that the chef and the man that you are today, have you sort of taken little elements of these different mentors? Because they all must be different, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question, Dave. You're absolutely right. All three of them. I look back at Gary now and think how far ahead of his time he really was. So when I was working for him, he was all about championing British produce.
Yeah.
He was all about like simplicity, because I'd come from thinking that food was about getting as many elements as you can on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And with Gary, it was sort of almost you just focused on two or three things, but they were so meticulous.
Yeah.
Then moving from there to Royal Hospital Road for Gordon Ramsay, that was incredible, brutal, baptism of fire, those things. It was, and I don't know what it was, something just drew me to go and work for Gordon. I was working for Gary. Sometimes I'd go back home and see my family, and then I'd get the National Express from Victoria and it would go down Royal Hospital Road. And I'd want it to stop. And I'd look at the chefs and they would be out. Some of them would be outside in the cold, passing sauces through muslin, opening scallops. And Gordon was not on television. Nobody from a public perspective knew who Gordon was. But you knew who he was if you were in hospitality. Yeah. And back then it was 2 Michelin stars. He had just left Aubergine to open Royal Hospital Road, by himself. And it was this... I don't know. It was just this sort of, there was something about that place that just drew me to go work there. Cause I had mates working for Pierre Kaufman. That was 3 Michelin stars, Marco Pierre White, 3 Michelin stars, Nico Ledenis on Park Lane, 3 Michelin stars.
Wow.
So I moved there, and then a year and a half later it won the 3rd star. And again, I didn't realize the sort of the importance of that and how historic that would go on to become, because if you think about how many 3 Michelin star restaurants there are in the United Kingdom, how often a 3 Michelin star restaurant comes along, and to be a part of that moment when it happened was incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Well, in terms of working with Gordon, I mean, I can. Do you remember the first Hell's Kitchen, which was down in the East End? It was the first TV thing. Well, I got an invite to go along. And you know what? When the cameras were turning, he was the foul-mouthed Gordon. But one thing which struck me was, as soon as the red lights went off, calm was in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Was that what it was like, or was it four-letter rants?
Yeah, absolutely. It's both.
Is
but
it?
what people, you know, you can never get the two mixed up. You know, the Gordon that you see now, or like the Hell's Kitchens, all of those. You know, yeah. Of course, there's a massive entertainment side to that.
Yeah.
But Gordon the craftsman, Gordon the technician, but also Gordon the leader. That was the biggest thing. After a while, my first week, I got thrown off service. You know, and it was back in those days as well. It was you know, throwing off was it, you know, grab by the back of the apron, off, go gone. Down and clean the fridge, gone.
Oh, right, okay.
And going, you know, and when I was working for Gary, I'd kind of moved up the ladder a bit. I thought I could cook. I was on the sauce section. I was a chef de party, and going somewhere like there was, and Gary Rhodes was brilliant, really high standard, but it felt a bit, if you look at it in sort of military terms, it was like, well, if Gary's was like the Marines,
yeah.
This was like going for special selection.
Yeah,
right? SAS.
Yeah, absolutely. And after the service, I knew it was him. You could tell his walk, and I'd only been there a week, and he came shooting down the stairs. I was cleaning out the fridge, literally like eyes were glazed. I was like, because I told my parents, I said, you know, there's a good chance I could get sacked from here. This kitchen has got a reputation. You have only the toughest survive.
Right.
But I knew that, you know, what I may lack in talent at that point, I knew I had in grit and determination. Yeah. I knew I would not give up. They'd have to kick me out screaming. Yeah.
Good on you.
So yeah, he came downstairs and he said, come here, let's have a sit down. And he was like, do you know why I threw you off service? I said, I messed up. He said, yep, you messed up. He said, but, you know, Paul, this is my first business. This is what I've put in. You know, I've got to make it work. I've had one, you know, told me about his career as a footballer and how that didn't work and being at Rangers. And he spent this time with me. And he was like, but he said, Paul, it's called Restaurant Gordon Ramsay. And he said, if it's wrong and it's not right and we don't get it right in that small window of time while they're dining with us, they walk away from here thinking that I am shit.
Yeah.
And he said, that's why it's hardcore. It's very, very, you know, full on and explosive. And he explained it to me and he broke it down. And from that moment, you know, that always stayed with me. And I took that into when it was, you know, my chance to open my first business. And it is. And I'm sure you relate to that, Jason.
That's kind of fair dues, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's a high pressure, passionate environment.
Yeah.
And there's all these pressures going on behind the scenes, which, you know, no one really, really knows about. And do you know what? I think we're all a bit too soft nowadays in business environment. Just get some passion on the job. And it was nice that he actually came and explained that. Because then it all makes sense.
Yeah.
It all made sense. And it made me understand that it wasn't personal, you know, and, you know, I've been asked this question before, you know, there was never, ever in my time, there was never no bullying. It was never done with malice. It was done with, it was passionate. It was full on.
Yeah.
And the moment, if you think about it, the moment that front house person comes and says, right, what would you like? And you order your starter, you order your main course. The clock is ticking in your head. You are right. I'm waiting for my experience. Yeah. I am waiting and I want it to be incredible. And it's costing this much. And this restaurant's got this reputation. Back then it was two Michelin stars. So there is absolutely no room for error. You know, everything coming up to that pass has to be incredible. And he had the most unbelievable, like, lieutenant as well, a guy called Mark Askew, which was, he was even more fierce, you know, even more fierce. But it was, I loved every single second of it. And some also as well, when the temperature rose, and as long as I wasn't on the receiving end of it, it made me like, come on, let's go.
As you say, Paul, it's the fact that, you know, the fact that he explained why he was doing what he was doing, you know, meant that he clearly wanted you to succeed. He wasn't doing it just for the sake of it or just to be a whatever, insert word that isn't really family friendly. Do you know what I mean? He actually wanted you to succeed. It's a bit like snakes and ladders, really, isn't it? You work your way up and every so often you need to drop back down again to kind of like start again. And, you know, that's all part of your sort of training. It's all part of your, I guess, your kind of sort of scar tissue in the kitchen, which is, is what you need. In terms of now, Paul, beautiful Padstow in Cornwall is home to your ever-growing restaurant and hospitality empire, which is brilliant. Mm. There is, of course, another famous chef who's fairly big in those parts. Were you welcomed in? A fellow called Rick Stein.
I don't know if you've
heard of him. But genuinely, like, you know, I've thought about this for a while, Paul, because, you know, when I watch the shows on TV. Were you welcomed in, or was it a little bit awkward? You know, is there a bit of a turf war? How does it work when, you know, from Rick's point of view, when you have another exciting new chef come onto his patch?
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. It was, I suppose, the best way to answer this question was I was introduced to Padstow by what is, you know, now someone who's a massive part of my life, an incredible mentor. And when I moved to Padstow, I knew how to cook. Mm. But I didn't have a clue how to run a business.
Right.
And I met an incredible chap called Derek, and he showed me how to run a business. And he introduced me to, you know, it's all very well being a good chef, and that's one thing. Mm. But you've got to know how to run a business. You've got to know how to turn a profit. And as we all know, even if you're not in hospitality, the margins are really, really tight. And you've got to be honest.
Especially now.
So I had this unbelievable sort of education, but one of the best pieces of advice he gave me right from the beginning was he knew Padstow really well. He had some properties there before in the past. He was buying number six anyway for his son. And he just said to me, listen, Rick's a really big deal down there and everybody wants to go and eat at Rick Stein. Going to eat at Rick Stein or any of Rick Stein's places is like the Harrods effect. People all go there and just, they'll go to any one of his places because they just want the bag. They want Stein's bag
and all of that. Yeah. Absolutely.
But he said, but you know what, Paul, they're not going to want to eat with Rick every night of their holiday and they're going to want an alternative. And he was like, don't go down there and compete. Go down there and compliment.
Yeah.
And a few years went by where nobody had a clue who we were. And we were just mopping up. We were the third night, fourth night restaurant.
Yeah.
And it was when I did Great British Menu and did quite well on Great British Menu that Oliver Paynton just one night, and back then as well, I wish we'd had the infrastructure we've got now, but back when he said this, we had a cordless phone that was connected to the chip and pin machine. So if someone was paying their bill, the phone would
People couldn't
work,
get and, through.
Yeah, and likewise. And if someone was on the phone, people couldn't pay their bill.
Right,
so
okay.
It was just, so we had that and we had a website. Anyway, Oliver Paynton on Great British Menu was like, you've got to get down to Padstow. There's a new kid on the block. And it went berserk.
Did it
like,
really?
Absolutely berserk, yeah. And yeah, I've always kind of, you know, I actually know Rick's wife more, or Rick's ex-wife, Jill. You know, I know, you know, Jill really well, and, you know, can honestly say it's always been amicable and nice. And I know the son, Jack, you know, really well. And yeah, you know, there's always been a bit of a feeling that there's enough room for everybody, but also now I think there is definitely a common ground that we complement each other.
Yeah.
And that whilst we're drawing people into Padstow who want to come and do one of the Ainsworth Collection, premises, they're, while we're here, let's go and have a Rick Stein experience.
Absolutely. You know, it can only be good for both of you. You know, I would imagine certainly in the long term, you know, I think you've sort of alluded to the fact that sort of early days and whatever, there's a little bit of settling in and there's finding your place and where are we and where's he, et cetera, et cetera. But in the fullness of time, you then make Padstow, which is a beautiful part of the world anyway, for those that haven't been.
Have you been down there, Dave?
Yeah, I have. It's beautiful.
Have you eaten at six or at the pub?
I haven't. No, I haven't. I haven't. I mean,
I've been fortunate enough a few times to eat.
Jason's done the quadruple, Dave.
Oh, has he?
He has.
Doesn't surprise me.
And emptied the minibar.
Which is probably even less of a surprise to you, Dave.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the thing, Paul. I know that you and Jason go back many years, as do myself and Jason. And to be honest with you, not much surprises me anymore, as I'm sure that you're the same. But no, I'm just going to say, you know, it can only be good for Padstow. It can only be good for both of you because it makes it into a destination for food lovers. And, you know, there's as well, the word that you used before, which I think was really telling, you used the word experience. You know, they're not just going going for a meal. They're going for an experience, you know, and it's a different type of dining, which you're serving up, which is wonderful.
So, Paul, next year, new book. Is that right?
That is right. My first ever cookbook.
And is it?
It's taken a long time on purpose. You know, it's one of those projects that when you say yes, it's huge. It's over 100 recipes. It's with an amazing publisher, HarperCollins. They've been amazing. They just want me to be able to pretty much do what I want to do. It's not a number six cookbook. So it's recipes that you will find from Cafe Reggiano's, The Mariners, things I love to do at home. And as we've been writing it and testing it, I would say 95% of this book is food in the middle of the table. Some of the, you know, like some of the recipes I've sent you, Jason.
I was just going to say, is that oxtail ragu in there?
Oxtail ragu is in there.
Mate.
And I think as we're coming to the end of it, we've got about 10 recipes left to write. We're shooting it right now. Mm-hmm. Last week we were in London. We've got the most amazing photographer, Izzy Crocker. She's just, it's mad because you're sort of seeing dishes like, I don't know, the buttermilk chicken from The Mariners. And when you sort of see it shot for, say, the website or Instagram, but then when you see it shot in a more of a lifestyle home and environment and a big tray of like fried chicken and... It's just brilliant. And
is that a whole different process in terms of shooting food for books?
Mm. Definitely. Absolutely different process. And John, who you know really well, so John's been with me for 18 years. So John's now our like group company director. So he's working on it with me. And then we've got an amazing home economist, Hannah, who's also just, you know, brilliant. So the team is fantastic. And it feels, I suppose why I've waited for so long to do it is that I wanted to have a really good reason, a real passion behind not just, oh yeah, chef does cookbook, you know, and join, as we all know, quite a saturated market. I wanted to have a real reason to write it. And also as well, now with all these recipes, you're doing them and you're like, do you know what? I know people are going to be like, I can do that. That's accessible. I can get all of those ingredients. But at the end of it, I know they're going to be, especially with the little tips, tricks, hacks, they're going to be, blimey, I've just made that.
Can I tell Dave about the ragu tip trick hack?
Yes. Mate, go for it.
It's an oxtail, so it needs to go in the pressure cooker and get it all, I'll use that word again, unctuous. And
umami.
But right at the end, you stir in some hydrated uvavu. I don't think there's such a product. But you stir in some hydrated seaweed, just a little bit.
Right.
Mate, it's rocket
fuel. Game changer.
Oh, it is, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's and that might sound like, oh, God, where am I going to get that, right? Seaweed, this dried seaweed salad, Dave, is available everywhere. Okay. To be honest, the easiest place to get it is Amazon.
Right.
Just go on Amazon,
buy this
seaweed salad, and then just literally, as Jason says, rehydrate it in some water. If you're really fancy, you can buy like dashi granules and rehydrate it in that.
Yeah.
And then just chop it up. But you're basically not adding any salt. You're just adding salt kind of in a more natural way. But
from the seaweed, yeah.
But that word that we've kind of developed on this podcast, uvami.
It's got loads of that.
It's got it just gives you loads of uvavu.
Do you know what? I think we might be onto something with this.
I think we are.
It's going to catch on, isn't it, in the world of Top Chefery.
Listen, the most important thing, Jason, which I don't know whether you've gathered so far, but it certainly is going around in my head, is that whether or not Paul has got a title for his new book, he may or may not have a title already, or the publishers may have a title in mind. But I would suffice to say that it might be getting changed now, or there might be some last minute 11th hour decision making, you know, on what it's called.
Paul Ainsworth.
I've got to say, Dave, you ask incredible questions. They are so on the point. Right. Well, listen to this. You lads, perhaps this could be the moment where we get the title for the book. We haven't got a title for a book yet. We've got a massive list. And
have you?
You know when we were at the Times building is, you know, that big glass building in London.
Yeah.
You know, and we all sat in one of those really smart, swanky offices around a table, and they were like, Paul, what would you like it to be called? So I've given you a bit of background. I was like, well, don't you think it'd be cool if it was called When You're Going to Do a Cookbook?
What did they say?
By Paul Ainsworth. And you know when, like, everyone, it goes a little bit quiet, and then you know when someone says, yeah, we'll sort of write that down, but we were thinking, you know, maybe sort of like Heart and Soul or Home Comforts. There's a lot of books with those titles, Paul's Kitchen, Paul's Home Kitchen. I was like, wouldn't it be a bit funny if it was a bit tongue-in-cheek? I said, because if I had a pound, I'm 44, I'm quite late to the party and writing a cookbook. I said, I do get asked quite a lot, have you not done a cookbook yet? When are you going to do a cookbook? So I thought, why don't we call it that?
Exactly. Make it literal. And then the next one, the follow-up, should be called The Difficult Second Book. You know the way that bands struggle with the second album? Because they put their heart and soul and their life's work into the first album. And then suddenly they've got 3 months to turn around the next one. Well, just knock something else out, lads. That's what it's going to be like.
Total mind block on the title, but here goes.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Listen.
Brilliant.
We've talked food possibly enough for those that are clamoring for some car action. So
yes,
take us back to the beginning, Paul, if you will, in terms of the motoring journey. Do you remember passing your test? Do you remember that day when you're presumably 17 years old? What happened?
Well, we can go back a little bit. It goes a bit before, but we'll quickly go on to two wheel. So my dad was absolutely nuts about motorbikes.
Okay.
And then he passed that on to me. So he was well into like British bikes. So I grew up, there was always motorbikes in the garage. Always, I suppose, living out the bikes you couldn't afford in the 60s. Right. So he had a beautiful like 1961 Triumph pre-unit Bonneville. And, there was like a BSA and Norton. It was always like, and all of his mates were into the old bikes. So when I was 10, he bought me an Italjet.
I remember them.
You remember them?
Yeah, Italjet. Was it a 50? Italjet
yes.
50 or
yeah,
80?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Right.
And then after that, he got me into trials bike riding and got me a Yamaha TY80.
Okay.
And a mutual friend of mine and Jason's, I went long before I met him. He used to take me to the NEC to watch the Lampkins. And his father and trials bike riding and all of that. So then as soon as I was 16, I got a Honda MT5. And then as soon as I was 17, I was chomping at the bit to pass my test because I just loved cars and bikes.
Yeah.
So I passed my test after the third time. Mm-hmm. Theory test took a bit.
Same,
theory test
same
took
here,
a bit
mate.
Longer. Yeah.
Yeah. Third time's best.
Not making any excuses, but like the theory test was just like, well, what is this thing, theory test? I remember one night, I was just out all night with my mates and went to the theory test and, of course, failed. Anyway, eventually I got the test and my first car that I saved up for cost me $2,500 and it was a Nova 1.3 SR.
Well, I tell you what, that's a pretty
good
start.
Yeah, it was a good start. The insurance
good
is exactly the same as the car. Mm-hmm. I then put some alloy wheels on it. I then went to your
6x9s on the parcel shelf. Do you have a bit of that?
Jason, I went next level on this. So there was a company there was a high street shop in Southampton in a place called Shirley called Just Ice.
Oh, nice. Right?
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Just Ice.
Yeah.
In car entertainment, just to for
okay,
anyone,
gotcha,
it was called Just Ice. Yeah. Mm. So I went with 6x9s on the parcel shelf, a 10-inch sub in the boot. Ooh. So there was no room in the boot for nothing else. It was just a sub. Mid-range on the back, just behind the seats. Yeah. Tweeters on the dash, and then the head unit was. Do you remember the Kenwood mask?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. The way it would flip down and all that. So, and this was in the days as well of the free ads. So I was always in the free ads, looking for second hand. I even went for, so I had the amps on the back of the, I had the amps, 2 amps, and they wired it, you know, when they wire it like that, all the way down.
Yeah.
With the, and they sold me the brass fittings because they said brass was a better conductor.
The whole works.
Yeah. And then 2 weeks later, I was visiting a friend. They just had a baby. The Princess Anne went out and it'd all been stolen. The whole lot. They'd even snipped the brass connectors that went into the amp.
Oh, man.
Absolute Neanderthals.
Yes. I know, because I'll tell you what as well. And the Prodigy, the Experience album had just hit. And honestly, I was just like, yeah, I thought I was the Dom. And I always remember the interior. It had no link to Burberry, but you know, the classic Burberry.
Yes, yeah. Did have a check, didn't it?
It was a Czech classic Burberry interior. Yeah, it was my art. Love that car.
See, I remember back in the day when my old man was was in the motor trade, and he brought back home, and I managed to get him to let me have it for the night, and it was a Nova Sport, the one with the twin 40 Webers on it.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh my God, what a rocket ship that was. I'm surprised that I didn't get a punch in the teeth, because it didn't go. I mean, it went back with a mark on some rims. Do you know what I mean? But weren't they great, those cars?
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Yeah, I saved up very, very hard for that. And it was definitely, as you say, compared to what my mates were driving, it was, but also as well, goes back to what you were saying earlier, Dave, as well. That was probably those early signs of definitely that discipline from my dad, working hard. Cause I was always working. So I was in that position to kind of go out and buy something. Yeah. You know, which was quite good for 17 years old.
Oh, mate, it's a proper car.
Do you know what? Proper car. I mean, as soon as you said that, I remember, and it takes me back as well, because I had a really good mate of mine at school, a guy called Andy Loveland, and his mum had one of those. She had like a silver one. This 1.3 SR.
I bet she was fit as well, eh?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't like to talk about...
Come on, Dave. Told us about this off air.
No, I haven't told you about this off air. Anyway, listen, back to the story. So we used to go down and sort of, you know, in the days before they used to lock up supermarket car parks and stuff and just have a little drive, because I wasn't old enough to drive, but he'd let us have a little drive around the thing. And we used to just have a cassette of James Brown in there for whatever reason. And like now, whenever I hear it, it just genuinely just takes me straight back to that silver Nova. And just beautiful, beautiful times.
Teleport. Just like poof, you're there.
It was brilliant. Yeah. Wow. So where does it go after that then, Paul? What where do you graduate from the Nova?
So I moved to London. So I kept it for a little bit. I kept it for a little bit longer. So I moved to London when I was 19, and I sold it because, you know, it's like you didn't need a car in London. And then my car history in. My next car I owned after that was really, really rubbish. But while I was working in London, that's when I met now my wife, Emma. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still there. It was called Miles and Miles Prestige. Right. And I'm like 19 years old, and they would let me hire anything. Wow. Really? And I would go, and I would go back to, you know, I had a few quid in my pocket. I was working hard in London. Back then, Royal Hospital Road was shut Saturday, Sundays. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were still, you know, you're still doing like 90 plus hour weeks, but I would hire the Mini had just been released, the Mini Cooper. So I was hiring like Mini Coopers, Polo, Volkswagen Polo GTRs. GTIs, yeah. Sometimes there would be like a Golf, he'd have like a Golf GTR there, and he would be like, look, do you know what? Have it for the same price as the Polo GTR. I was going back to Southampton, and Emma was hairdressing, and I was picking her up in like all of these like cars that were way too quick, and I shouldn't have been driving. But it was, I don't know, I didn't even really show me license. I would just go in there and say, yeah, same again, Paul. It was like, so that was where my car history was for quite some time.
Yeah.
Then when I moved to Cornwall, I didn't get a car straight away, but I had a Yamaha R6, so I had a nice motorbike that I was riding, and then I moved to Cornwall, and you've probably got a bit of an impression out of my dad, of what the character sort of what my dad was like. My dad always had something that he had for sale or on the drive, so I went home one day and he had a Peugeot 406. It was like a cross between a tank, a boat. It was just on the drive. He said, look, one of my tenants, because he had a few other block properties, he said, one of the tenants is, you know, I've just bought it off him. He says, you can have it for 450 quid. And I was like, okay. So I had it when I moved to Cornwall, and it was so rubbish.
Was it?
And for some reason as well, it just stank of petrol inside. And and bearing in mind as well, me, without going into too much detail, me and Emma had had a break as well. We'd parted company, Anyway,
can that you were stinking of gas all the time.
Yeah. And then Emma comes back into my life in 2008, and all of a sudden, I've gone from the guy that used to work in London, come down. I was like this in these nice cars from this hire company. I pick her up from the coach station in this. Brilliant. I mean, it was just embarrassing. Mm. It was just really, really embarrassing. So yeah, Peugeot 406. Then we sold that and we bought the business, and I didn't pay myself a salary or anything. We bought the business in 2009. So that's when it became Paul Ainsworth number six.
Yeah.
And we would smoke around in Emma's Renault Clio. Mm-hmm. So we had Renault Clio. And then
did you go electric? You got the little BMWs on the
front. No, that's much later. Yeah, that's the townhouse car. Then I bought a Fiesta Ghia.
Okay.
After that, yeah, Fiesta Ghia. Again, because it was just everything was just about trying to get the business off the ground.
Yeah.
And Emma was hairdressing, so we lived off of her wage. It was right at that point of, you know, we'd had that Labour government for about 15 years with Tony Blair, the Tories came in, and the success story really for us was bought the business, didn't pay myself a salary or anything for 3 years. We lived off of Emma's wages, but I was on an interest only mortgage that went from, £1,295 a month down to £205 a month, because interest rates were just dropping.
Yeah, yeah.
So whilst it was a recession, my mum was like, what are you doing? Don't do it. Don't buy a business. My dad was like, Annabelle, let him get on with it. If he thinks he can make it work, he'll make it work.
Good old dad.
Like this. Yeah, dad was there again. And and that was, so my car history was very,
It's a bit stop start, isn't it? But the other thing I was going to say was, not only obviously I get the fact that you don't want money tied up in cars because you're trying to put everything, you know, you and Emma put everything into the business to try and, you know, give it the lift that it needs. But is there also an element of, because I've got friends that live down in Cornwall, and when you've got little tiny little windy streets, is there also an element of the fact that you just want something where you don't really mind if it gets knocked a bit? Because you're parking in funny little places. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, well, back then, yeah, exactly that, and had no choice. But I think when it came good, Dave was, and we still love this car. We even had a name for it. It was called Aubrey, and it was our first. It was an Audi S3,
nice.
Right? And it felt like, you know, right. Oh my God, got an Audi, and it was just, and it was amazing. It was a beautiful car, and we bought it from Tresillian Cars in Truro, Audi garage, and that felt like, do you know what, we're on our way, got a nice car, the hard work was paying off, and we had that car for about 3 years. Then CC came along, and we went to I tell you what, I did have for 12 months, which was, I had to get rid of it because Em was pregnant. And the Audi S8, do you remember with the one with the Gallardo engine in it?
Yeah.
What a motor. Mm. Like, had that for 12 months. It was completely and utterly, as you could, because it was a saloon, but it was a small boot. It wasn't very Cornwall friendly.
No, it
was loud, but it was incredible.
It's a wafter car, isn't it?
And it was one of those things, and you'll tell me better than me. It was one of those cars that I actually wish I'd hung on to and just put a cover over it and put it in the garage, because I don't know, it's got that feeling of a future classic with that Lamborghini engine in it.
Quite possibly, actually. There was a V10 in there.
The V10.
Yeah, quite possibly. I bet if you drove it today, even if it had been in the garage for quite a few years, it'd still feel amazing.
Yeah.
Wasn't it the same engine out of the R8 that they had in there?
That's it. Yes.
I think they did.
Yes.
It was the same engine, wasn't it? It was
V10.
Yeah. Electric everything. Like poo cookers, poo coolers. Massaging seats, heated steering wheel. It'll have everything, won't it?
Yeah. It was phenomenal. So, yes, I had that for 12 months. And then we got a Q7, which was great. Really sort of practical. Mm-hmm. Really, really good, especially with, you know.
Am I detecting a little deal with Audi here? A little
Thanks to my good friends at Tresillian Audi.
I would be lying if I didn't ask someone there, say, look, is there a, you know, sort of got some restaurants in Padstow? And it was because it wasn't a main Audi dealer. It was like a sort of like a franchise dealer. Mm. It was just, no, we don't need anything from you. Yeah, I mean, they didn't say it exactly like that, but it was very much like,
oh, was it?
No. We're good. Yeah. Just you are buying our cars. We are giving you a car. That's as far as this transaction needs to go.
I love that day, expression. Mr. Ainsworth. No,
we're good.
Like, I just so you know, I'm on like my fourth car from you. Is there anything to be done here? Mm, you know, we've got restaurants. Is there any of your customers that would like to come? No.
No, thank you.
Hey, listen, if you don't ask, you don't get, Paul.
Exactly,
You know that.
Hey, so here's a question, Paul. Tell me about, there was like a special little road trip with you and Sat Baines and Kerridge.
Yeah.
Tom, you know.
Yeah.
Marlow to Marseille or Marlow to Maastricht or somewhere? What was it?
Well, you know Tom really well, and he had... For many, many years, Tom had said, you know, his dream thing to do on his 50th birthday would be to sort of drive through France, you know, in his cars. And also as well, when he was talking to me about this years and years ago, you know, he didn't have these cars, you know, that he's got now. So he was said he'd love to do it with his closest mates. And, you know, he was, I think what was really nice about it was, because someone had been talking about it for such a long time, and then, you know, you're finally doing it. It was, so he had the 355, his 911, and a E30, real classic, E30. Yeah. So there was six of us. So we all drew straws. So one of you would be obviously passenger in what car, and one of you would be driver. And we just kept doing that. And in total, it was 855 miles. We stopped it, a two-star, Jean-Michel Laurent. Then we drove down to Bernard Loiseau. That was an unplanned stop, but absolutely phenomenal.
Really?
You know, his daughter, because he sadly took his life many, many years ago. And the rumor, you know, always said, you know, the rumors of losing his third star, or he was going to lose third star and all of this, because obviously it is, you can imagine, it's a big deal to chefs in the UK, but in France it's such an institution. So his wife, who's now the CEO, she took us around the whole estate, so that was incredible. And then we finished in Marseille and we ate it, Gerald Passaday, and it was magic.
Had a huge bowl of bouillabaisse.
Exactly that. But you know, like, you know, all those years when you're sort of watching, like, you know, your Top Gears and your, you know, your Fifth Gears and all of those, and they do these incredible mega road trips, where there was these couple of moments where it was just like open road. You know, you're going through these winding roads, chateaus, town. The sun, the sky was orange. It was golden hour, and you're like, this is incredible. I'm actually doing this. This is absolutely brilliant. Plus also with the chef side of things and doing it in France, it was, very magical.
Oh, wow. I bet. I mean, Jason, can you imagine sort of driving through France with these guys in those cars? I mean, it's just superb.
Can you imagine the restaurants which they'd sniff out or they'd know about?
Exactly.
Can you imagine?
They're not stopping at the services for a ham and cheese croissant, are they? I mean, they're getting proper gear. My question to you, though, Paul, is that surely you've got to know where to park in Marseille, haven't you? Because it's a bit tasty, Marseille. I've been there, and I'm not sure I'd... You've got to know what you're doing there, haven't you?
All of it was shocking. It was it? We arrived.
I mean, genuinely, it's got a... I don't know. Yeah. Have you been to Marseille, Jason? It's got a real edge. I've been there in the lunchtime, and I was a bit like...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You're right. So we arrived at this unbelievable, you know, you've got in your head what you think you're going to be arriving to, and it was nothing like what I thought in my head. And I'd never been to Marseille until this point. So you're going down this lane, which was ridiculously tight. And luckily as well, I was in the Porsche at this point as well. Like the Ferrari was quite wide and, like, you know, old school Ferrari. And also as well, it's also more nerve wracking when it's not your car.
Yeah. Like, so let Kerridge put it down the little narrow ones. Because if anyone's going to ding it, make sure it's him and not you.
Yeah. And then it's just all like it's quite edgy, as you say. So it's all graffiti and stuff. And it's like, look, you know, there's lots going on. It's packed. Obviously, there's lots of attention. We got there kind of late afternoon. Everyone's looking at the cars. And then there was this lad who was just absolutely off his nuts, like with his mates. And he was just out of it. And he was just wanting to fight everyone. right, like everything and everyone. So we're kind of, we get out of the cars and we're trying to wait to get down another narrow lane because that's the entrance to this free Michelin star restaurant. And it was so sketchy for about 20 minutes because you're like, you're either going to ding the car or this prat is either going to jump on it, throw something at it, jump on us. Yeah, it was mental.
I remember going sort of to the old, to the old town and the harbour and had lunch around there, but arrived with my missus at the time and our kids, and we got off the train station. Train stations in any big city, as you know, are normally kind of like where the ne'er-do-wells kind of hang around. And so we came out, and of course we've got our luggage with us as well. So we look like the Griswolds from some kind of National Lampoon's European Vacation, right? Walking down the street, you've got all these guys kind of like eyeing us up thinking, oh yeah, right.
Okay, we'll have them.
Yeah, these, we'll have
this, these, this lot sitting ducks. I tell you what, genuinely, I couldn't wait to get back into the safety of Marseille Airport, actually, because it did have a... Yeah, I had a real edge, I think, but you know.
You didn't have a football shirt on.
I didn't have a football shirt on.
Good life, because that could have been costly.
Yeah, no, I didn't have one of those. But unbelievable trip, though, I reckon, Paul, that.
Yeah, it was. It truly was. And yeah, like I say, doing it in and three very different cars as well. Mm. You know, getting to do it in those cars was brilliant. And yeah, the only one I didn't draw the straw on was the BMW.
And okay, the old school.
And do you know what? Le Mans was on when we got through to the other side.
Right.
And there was loads of young kids with their little notebooks taking pictures. Because as you can imagine, there was loads of great cars coming off off of the Eurotunnel. But we pulled into this garage just as we come off, just to rejoin. And it's mad, isn't it? The car that got the most attention was the BMW.
Was that
E30. These young kids were, and they all had these Instagrams and they were tagging us in and they were like, what's your Instagram handle? And then they just film you going off and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, considering these kids must have been 15, 16 years old. Like the BMW, the E30 was the one that got the most attention. They loved it.
Brilliant.
Funny though, isn't it, Jason? We've had this conversation a few times with people whereby I think almost there's a bit of a saturation in terms of supercars on the likes of Instagram, and people see Ferraris and Lambos and stuff all the time. And actually, it's when you have stuff that's arguably, you know, slightly more ordinary or rare and things like that. Or the thing that's coming into my head is that when we had, you know, God bless him, we had Maxi Jazz on this show, a few years ago. And and he had this old kind of Mark II Escort. He had like an old Mexico that he was talking about. And he said, honestly, when I drive down, people point and I'm like that. And you'd be like that as well, Paul. Absolutely. You know, these are the cars of our youth. And these are far more head turning and traffic stopping for me than any kind of Aventador or Ferrari or anything like that.
Totally agree with that. Totally agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
So are you into classic stuff at all, Paul?
I am. Yeah. With your questions, I know I've gone right for the top one here, but seeing one of these in the flesh.
Oh, do tell.
Which I did it just blew me away. And actually a couple of weeks ago, there was a brilliant program on, it was Sky documentary, but it was actually sort of like the life and times of Enzo Ferrari, but it was
a great program.
Yeah. And really it was, great. You know, his drivers and, you know, the ones, yeah, just the, you know, those, Mike, help me out here, Jason.
Mike Spence.
No.
Haywood,
yeah, and all just the life and times of those and what they did and the racing and stuff. But yeah, the Ferrari 250 GTO 1962.
Oh my God.
I mean, I know that's like going right at the, but it's got the history and obviously the price they go for. But you know, when you see one of those in the flesh. And yeah, I remember going to the classic car show.
Yeah.
And in Germany, went with James.
Yes.
Yeah, in Germany, and they had like all the classics there, and like just seeing one of those is breathtaking.
Yeah, proper bit of kit that was.
Absolutely breathtaking.
Oh, I know.
Ferrari flat 12 engine, boxer engine, like oof, hello.
Yeah.
It was There was one at Salon Privé couple of years ago when I was there at Blenheim Palace. It was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, as you would imagine, drew quite a crowd.
And it's, you know, and there's, I mean, there's so many in there. But, yeah, just seeing one of those. I mean, they look, when you see one in one of the big double, you know, coffee table style books, is a photograph of it is beautiful. But to see it in the flesh is something else. And then to go really new, staying in, you know, again, it's just, I saw the sort of first time I saw one, a car that I was like, that is, it's just the colours it was in as well. But it was at Carfest, Jason, and it was Chris Evans had that, the TDF in the cream with the kind of, I'd never seen navy blue carbon. It was like that kind of creamy kind of color, like pearlescent, like the 812 super fast, but just in that the way at it spec.
Yes, it's almost like a dyed naked carbon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's really, it was spectacular, isn't it?
But this new one, or recently new one, the 812 Competizione in the matte gray with the yellow going down the middle, it might just in my humble up, it is the most, those two, the 250 and that, are the most beautiful cars I've ever seen in my life.
It's difficult to argue with that, isn't it? You know, I mean, you know, there's some great things that you could select, but in terms of the ones that you just picked out, I think it's difficult to say any different there. Paul, we are rapidly approaching time on this. We've got two questions which we ask everybody, which I'd like to wrap up with, because I think that you will give great answers on this, I have no doubt. Jason, I'm going to do the first one. You do the second one. The first one goes a little something like this. Of all the cars you've ever owned, you need to pick one and one only and stick with it for the rest of your life. Now, bearing in mind, it's got to do everything as well. So think about your life, where you live, your family, your children, your expanding. Which one is it and why of all the things you've owned?
I'm going to go with BMW X6 competition.
Okay.
X6, is that the one? Is that the one with the
funny
kind of
back on it?
The it's got a nice bum to it. It's quite an interesting shape.
Yeah,
is that the one?
Because it's exactly that. It's because it does everything. That it's not 4x4, but it is. It's all wheel drive. Yeah. It sounds great. It's quite nice in Cornwall as well, as being slightly higher up. It looks beautiful, in my opinion. It's rapid, but it also can be in comfort mode as well. And it
are we talking the one with the V8 in there? Obviously,
that's it.
I knew it.
I think it's V8. I think it's V8 4.4. It's got a nice bit of carbon on it. But if I had, as you say, Dave, if I've got to have it for the rest of my life, because it's all the things you said earlier about the S8 all those years ago. It's massage seats. It's just, and also as well, the seats look quite gnarly and very sort of like, but they're really comfortable. They're not like, they're really, really comfortable. I love it. And if I had to have, of all the cars I've owned, if I had to have something for the rest of my life, it'd be that one. BMW X6 M Competition.
Can't,
it's good
can't,
choice
can't
that, David.
Absolutely. You know, and I always think you've got to bear in mind two words with that question. Tip runs. You know, can you do the tip run in it? No. Therefore, it doesn't count. That's what
Like I'd love to say the Nova 1.3 SR, but I would be basing that purely on nostalgia. Yeah. But if you really got to think about this question and have it for, you know, another, you know, touch wood, 40 years. Then I've got to take those things into account.
Here we go. This is, we love this question because it kind of sets the scene for so much about what cars do for us. So music and cars, we always think, just go hand in hand.
So we want your
fantasy drive. So where are you? Where are you going? What you're listening to, but most importantly, what fantasy car are you driving?
Right. So it's gonna be that 812 Competizione in the grey and the yellow. It's got to be that. It's gonna be a playlist. It's gonna be a mixture of some absolute classic, awesome house. like house music.
I like it.
Then gonna have a little. It's, I'm gonna pepper it then with a bit of kind of Guns N' Roses, a bit of AC/DC in there, and then we're gonna go for a bit of Al Green.
So it's a bit of soul,
bit of smoothness and stuff, you know. But you know, like the nice kind of great uplifting Al Green.
Yeah,
I reckon you're gonna get nicked on this trip. You're gonna get nicked for speeding loads, aren't you? With that playlist.
Especially when Faithless Insomnia, the extended remix comes on. You just know that's going to make you drive. That's just going to make you drive faster.
Absolutely.
In terms of roads, I would definitely be going back to France where we were, because we only scratched the surface. But there's someone at the door,
Paul.
There is, yes. We're going to let them in. Yeah, we can just pause that, Lance.
Honestly, it's fine. Just let them in. We don't even have to pause it. I mean, that's how relaxed the show
it.
Is.
Okay,
is
I can do just, it on my phone.
We can just talk, you know.
You all right, I'm Roger?
Hi, Paul, how you doing?
Yeah, no worries. There you go, mate.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Do you know who that was, Jason? Roger Daltrey. Right, Roger Daltrey.
Do you know what? I thought I recognised that lisp of his.
Tell you, popping around for a pint of milk.
Lads, I'm just going to... That was Roger the window cleaner.
Ah, okay.
Is that what he's doing now?
Yes.
which, by the way, sounds like one of those films in the 70s. Do you remember? Like Roger the window cleaner and stuff.
Do you know what? This is a very, as you said earlier, Dave, a very clean podcast, but we could go further with that one, couldn't we? Roger the window cleaner.
I just thought, I just realised.
Listen. I think on that note, I think we should let you crack on with your day, let you go and see Roger the window cleaner. I'm being very careful what I say here, Jason. I think on that note, you should take us out.
Oh, that's a close one. Well, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs, and it'll help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thanks to you, but a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Roger the window cleaner. I'm sorry, Paul Ainsworth.
Do you know what? Thanks so much for having me. That was an absolute scream. Thanks,
honestly,
Dave. Loved
it. It was brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plater or at Dave Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Well, that's it, unfortunately, for this week. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.